Jackson, author of 9 Gateways to Presence. We're talking about the gifts, working around the Enneagram from the body type to the heart type. And we're moving right into head type with 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah. Thank you, Travis Glenn. It's a funny thing how in a lot of spiritual traditions, people say weird things like you don't need your head or your head's the problem. I don't know. If my child was sick, I don't want to go and have the doctor and just tell the doctor, just feel for my child. You know, you don't need to know anything about medicine. Just care about my child. This is madness. When we're confronted with global crises, we're not going to solve them just by feeling something. Heart's very important. Heart motivates. Body gets us aligned with what we're actually going to do. But the mind is very important to understand because like the heart, there's a deeper mind. And the deeper mind is where our creativity comes from, our insights, our ahas, our realizations. You don't have a realization in your body. The so-called enlightenment experience happens where? In your mind. So the mind is very important, but it can't get there without the body and the heart. So again, the Enneagram is telling us how we need to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. We need to get all these different parts of us working together and lining up in presence. So what's the head bring? Point five happens to be my home base. Point five is about the capacity of realizing things, noticing things. Aha. Oh my God, that hadn't occurred to me. Wow, look at that. That particular capacity of the human mind to recognize and discover something new, to see through what appears to be to a deeper truth. And we wouldn't have got anywhere as human beings if we didn't have that capacity. So, you know, people who have five as their main point, they're focused on that. They want to set up their life in a way where there's an opportunity to keep discovering things, learning new things, exploring. It doesn't have to be anything of particular interest to anyone else. It just intrigues me. So I might spend 25 years studying a very particular thing, and I'm fine with that. So like trying to learn about things in depth, and through that, coming up with innovative ideas. That's the gift of five. A lot of discoveries and inventions and things like that come from this point. And when we're not so present, that mind is still operating, but we're not always understanding the context of what we're learning, what we're doing, what we're contributing. The recent movie Oppenheimer was about a five who's torn between his desire to understand and solve this problem and wrestling with the implications of solving it. Like, okay, so now we can do this. And what are humans going to do with this thing I discovered?
As you say that, I instantly recognize it. And I was also thinking of another person that I tend to think of might be a five, Albert Einstein. Mm-hmm. But in relationship to not just external innovation, but also internal, the oft-quoted Einstein when he said, we can't create the solution from the same consciousness that created the problem. And so he's really talking about the unknown quality of what transformation or integration might actually mean. At one level, we can't even imagine what is possible because we're not there yet. And whatever we think of now might not be what it is. So this unknown synthesis and evolution that the five brings, it blows my mind when I think of it that way.
Oh, yeah. And you know, it's not only in science or engineering. I mean, a lot of fives are artists and they do innovative things in art. I used to go and watch the choreography of Merce Cunningham. It was most definitely a five who kind of deconstructed the whole idea of how dance worked in a way that was scandalous to people at first. But now everybody goes, oh, yeah, Merce Cunningham. But it's just like being willing to go out on a limb to try something different and see how it flies.
Are the fives often then misunderstood at their moment of conception or inception of introduction?
Yeah, I think that a lot of times what they're doing is divisive from the point of view that some people are going to go, wow, that's great. That's so cool. And other people are going to say, what the heck is that? And I think of like the music of Philip Glass. It's just, you know, like, what is he doing? You know, what is this? John Cage, who was Merce Cunningham's partner in life. Whether they're doing art or science, it's something that people don't already know. So it's sort of inviting people out of the circle of the known into a bigger unknown. And of course, that usually creates reactions. Now, the downside of it, though, is that fives can get pretty freaky and they can get real out there in their ideas. And when they're trying to focus on what they're studying, they tend to isolate. They don't talk to people. They don't connect. Or even if they do, they don't really let people in on what's going on in them. And in that isolation, there's no checks or balances on what they're thinking about. And they can get into some very dark and strange places. These innovative, you know, David Byrne, someone I've spent time with, is definitely a five, and some filmmakers too. But yeah, I just want to say all that to get us out of the idea that they're only scientists, because they're not always the case.
Right. Good, good. Well, let's move into the six and explore the gifts there.
Well, six is one of the points I think least understood in Enneagram circles sometimes. Sixes appear to be all over the map from one point of view, but they're really not. They represent the part of mind that when we're present, embodied with our heart and our mind opens up, it shows that we know intuitively, wordlessly, immediately how to respond to the world, how to respond to the moment, what to do next, turn left, turn right, go forward, stop, what? And so it's kind of one of my friends and mentors, A.H. Almas, Hamid Ali, who is a five, but he talks about guidance. And there's different forms of guidance. And this is the guidance on how to live, how to live your life, how to interact with people. Your teenage daughter's having a crisis, and your mind might go crazy thinking of what you want to say to her. But if you're smart, in that moment of being present and you're sitting with her, you're being a good listener, and the right words just come to you. That's what I mean by guidance. And sixes are the people who also feel responsible to keep this ship of humanity afloat. They're always looking at how to make things work, how to keep things going, how to keep things from falling apart, which is a huge thing. Imagine the world without that. They're often unsung heroes. They do a lot of beautiful things. They don't necessarily need a lot of attention, or and sometimes they're even embarrassed by people praising them too much. But on the other hand, of course, they do like it if someone notices that they did something good. But sixes can be in the arts. They can be in engineering. They can be the professions. They could be line workers. They're just anywhere. But they have this orientation toward steadying the ship, making things work, and being responsible to help things work. When they're not so present, that guidance goes away, and then they're kind of freaking out because they feel like they don't know what to do. And then they overthink it. Their mind goes crazy. Well, I could do this. But on the other hand, what if I do that? But if I do that, this will – and then Mary might get upset with me. And then, you know, it's like becomes this overheated overthinking. I used to call it yes, but mind.
I think of the sixes in my life that when it does occur to me to reach out for help and let them know that something's off center a little bit, they are there. They are solid. And this quick triage factor kicks in. So it's interesting to hear that challenge in applying that to themselves, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yes. When the situation calls for it, they're usually right there. And I always tell the sixes that they do better in real life than they do in their minds. You know, they actually have more talent, more capacity, more competence than they think, because their tendency is to doubt themselves and to doubt the situation, right? Which is coming out of that caution, because they're trying to make sure they don't mess up and that the right thing happens. In that respect, they're sort of like a cousin of point one, you know, the two most responsible types on the Enneagram.
Right.
But I think that they just they get caught in that overthinking. They get more suspicious, more self-doubting, more anxious, and sometimes do various not great things to quell their anxiety. They also sometimes when we talk about six, we talk about sixes being phobic or counterphobic, meaning some sixes will just get more and more cautious and careful, and some sixes just get sick of all the going round and round in their head, and they just do something impulsive to get out of it. And they usually do something that goes against what they're afraid of. They'll tell off the boss, they'll go rock climbing, they'll go riding their motorcycle fast, something like that. And they learn that by doing kind of risky things, it temporarily relieves them from their anxiety.
This seems like, it's always been easy for me to look at adjacent types and kind of see the flavors of entanglement that we have with that. But it always confounds me a bit looking at the six, and we're going into seven here. And so the six to seven movement, can you help me understand that a little bit better, where they're similar, but where they're also different?
Sure. Well, the five, six, and seven are all based in anxiety. The five feels anxious and retreats, disconnects, withdraws. The six feels anxiety and is trying to work out what to do, how to handle things, how to keep the world from caving in. They're kind of handling things all the time. Seven is also very anxious, although sevens have this deep rooted anxiety, and they deal with it by keeping interesting things happening, by doing adventures, experiences, things that fascinate me, by keeping my mind occupied. I can control my anxiety. And I always joke that sevens have a secret code word for when their anxiety is coming up. They call it boredom.
I was going to say fun.
Well, boredom is just, well, fun is what, but they're not, it's sometimes they're just reading an interesting book, or they're going to a workshop or whatever. It wouldn't, sometimes sevens get treated a little lighter. Sevens can be brilliant, innovative, also very devoted. They sometimes people will say of sevens that they're not very loyal, or that they're not. And I don't find that to be necessarily true. When a seven is in trouble, they're all over the map. So anyone's guess. We don't know what they're going to do, and they don't know what they're going to do. But when sevens have even a modicum of presence, and they're very loyal. Sevens are terrified of losing their freedom. Because part of the inner life of the mind is that it's expansive, it's open-ended, it's limitless. And we experience that on an emotional level as the feeling of inner freedom. But we're not present, it feels like we lost it.
I'm speaking with Russ Hudson, author of 9 Gateways to Presence. If you want to know more about his work, you can go to russhudson.com. RussHudson.com. Or you can get there at newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm speaking with Russ Hudson, author of 9 Gateways to Presence. And Russ, I'm wondering for our listeners, I know in your book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram, there's a few quick questions that can help lead them to maybe where they might want to investigate and start their journey. But I'm wondering what other resource you might offer for our listeners to go to and find out what their type might be.
Right. Well, couple of things. First off, I just want to remind people that your type is not your identity. It's a form that you take. It's a way you've learned to operate in the world, a way to handle your emotions, the way you try to manage other humans and deal with life. And it, as such, is a very important thing to know, but it isn't the final statement of what you are as a soul, as a conscious entity. That being said, we've devised a lot of different ways that people can help find their dominant, I prefer to say dominant type. So we have, as I said, the tests that are in the Wisdom of the Enneagram. There are two of them in there. Years ago, I worked with my dear friend and colleague, Don Richard Riso, and we developed a test called the Riso-Hudson Enneagram Type Indicator, R-H-E-T-I, READY. And you can find that at the Enneagram Institute. And that has been a pretty tried and scientifically tested instrument. So I always tell people with tests, use it as a piece of evidence. It's just to help you think along certain lines. I don't think anybody could devise a test that would perfectly get it right every time. That just in any form of psychology, it's not just the Enneagram. So to take your results with a grain of salt and just ponder what you get from the results. Beyond that, you can go to workshops. There are live ones. These days, there's a lot of them on Zoom. You can check out with friends who are the teachers that you relate to or that are reputable. And there's a lot of ways. And I think in the long run, knowing your number is one thing. Knowing how to use that knowledge to help you develop is another. And that you're going to get from going to a workshop or joining a group or things like that. I would say that the Enneagram is not like a quickie thing to study. It takes time to really derive the benefits that it can bring to your life.
There are different words to this, to how to work with it. And using the Enneagram for some of these synonyms, awakening, transformation, or integration. And so I think it's interesting also that each type within that has ascending and descending characteristics within these versions of transformation, integration, and awakening. And yes. So I'm wondering how to best go about thinking about this.
Well, there's several angles of that. The Enneagram is all about that. At the core of it, like when we were talking about the heart, is what is referred to as it's an alchemical process, the conversion from the passion or the suffering of our type into the virtue of our type, which I would say is learning to be present with our suffering in such a way that it starts to be transmuted. In Judeo-Christian Islamic terms, we'd say by grace. And in that transformation, slowly, it changes the kind of person we are. The Enneagram work is not just about having a cool spiritual experience. We need those, but they're insufficient. Having had such an experience, what are the implications of it? I've seen that all is one. So who am I having breakfast with? You know, and so there's a journey of learning to be a kind of person who is emanating the understanding and the compassion that comes from this inner journey. Because a person who has been able to digest, in a sense, their own suffering is in a position to hold the suffering of others and help them in their healing journey. And I think that's really at the root of all the serious spiritual traditions. Now, the Enneagram itself, each type, Don Riso did a lot of work on discriminating the healthy, beautiful, higher side of the type from the sort of normal range, which is called the average range, where we're just our everyday garden neurotics, you know, just doing what we do. And then there's the unhealthy, or what in the Wisdom of the Enneagram we call it the type in trouble, where we look at how you can get into really difficult territory in the deeper sides of the type when you get too identified with these defenses. Also, the Enneagram has, as a symbol, it kind of looks a little freaky for some people, some kind of strange star or something, but the inner lines are meaningful. They're not just there to decorate. They're not just there to scare fundamentalists or something. They imply interconnections that are important for helping us get out of the box of our own type.
You used the word defenses, and it's a common word, but I'm wondering in this context what that actually means.
Well, from the Enneagram point of view, and from a lot of the point of view of psychology, all ego structures are to some degree defensive. A lot of them arise as a way to handle emotions or experiences that were too difficult for us to handle when we were small children. They were objectively overwhelming. And so we had to learn certain psychological tricks. We had to learn things to do with our attention to sort of manage what seemed unmanageable to us as little kids, and probably was. But now that we're adults, we have resources available to us that we didn't have then. So we can very gently begin to investigate these defenses and to get in touch with what we defended against. You know, all real psychology, all spiritual healing deals with that one way or another. And the Enneagram is just saying, this is a good place to dig. Check this out right here. And the lines, the internal lines, give us some clues about that. If you look at the Enneagram symbol, there are two internal lines connected to each point. One of them is called the direction of integration, or sometimes the security point. The other is called the direction of stress. When one of them indicates an ingredient that we need to integrate, but it's kind of shadow for us. And that's the integration direction. So, for example, as a five, my integration point is eight. And that means I actually have eight-ish tendencies, not necessarily the nice ones, but I don't like to see that. I don't like to own that. Me, bossy, controlling, dominating, I'm just a little five. I'm just an intellectual. No, I am bossy and demanding and so forth. But when I get in touch with that, it actually represents something I need. Because as a five, I need embodiment. I need the felt sense of presence, which opens up the real power of my mind and heart. And without that, I can't get too much out of the box.
When I hang out with my friends, and there's other types and numbers, I'm talking about it, the thing that I'm most afraid of and the scariest thing is like a piece of cake for someone else.
Right.
And I really can't believe the ease of that is real for you.
Yeah, it's like we take for granted the gifts that we have. Like you said, can't everybody do this? No, probably not. Or maybe they could eventually come to it, but it's going to be a journey for them. Whereas for me, it's sort of right next door.
I think in this way, we can help each other by looking at other gifts. But I also feel the solidarity of hanging out with other like-minded types. And for me, it's more inspiring to see others of my type who are in more in the world and take their place and get into that eight energy. So I think we need others, but I also think we need our own family to look at as well. And so I love both these configurations.
Yeah, I've often thought that each of us, once we've done some of our own inner journey, some of our inner work, that we become kind of an ambassador of a certain necessary segment of the human family, of human consciousness, and that, you know, we remind other people that this is part of them and that they have access to this too. That's part of my joy as a five, is just helping people feel smart. I think you can learn this stuff. You're brilliant more than you realize. You have the capacity to inquire and to come to new understanding.
And so I'm wondering, Russ, if we're a coach or a therapist, if we're using the Enneagram, if one of our frameworks, is that part of our role also to be within what the essential essence of each type might offer and move towards that?
Absolutely. There's a couple things when we're facilitating another individual. One is to get a little freedom from our own filter. because we have an idea of what a good result's going to be coming out of our perspective, but that may or may not be appropriate for the person that we're trying to help. Now, the other thing is, as you said, I find whether I'm teaching a group or an individual, when it really lands for people, the truth of their true nature, their inner nature, their essence, as we call it in the Enneagram, is they really get the sense, oh my gosh, that's true. That is who I am. That is what I love. That is what I care about. Then it's not as big of a deal to look at the little tangles that we get into from our egoic consciousness. And you also then understand it's not our job to get rid of the ego, which is probably even a bad idea. It's to have it take its proper place. And when you see it, when you can deal with some of the underlying emotions that keep pulling us back, and you're also holding the place of what you are, this expanded sense of self, there is just a very natural and organic process that takes place where we become real human beings, you might say.
I've been speaking with Russ Hudson, author of 9 Gateways to Presence. If you want to know more about his work, you can go to russhudson.com, RussHudson.com, or you can get there through newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3813.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dean Radin, author of Real Magic. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about ancient wisdom, modern science, and a guide to the secret power of the universe.
Looking for a community who will support you on your academic journey? The Student Learning Commons has got your back. The Student Learning Commons is SFU's Academic Success Center. We provide free workshops, one-on-one consultations, coaching, and online tutoring with a focus on writing, study skills, and academic English. All Student Learning Commons programs and services are available to SFU students and are approved by SFU as providing ethical, academically honest support. Learn more by visiting our locations in the library on all 3 SFU campuses, or check us out online at learningcommons.sfu.ca.